The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Grim reading, but does the Children's Hospital report tell us who is to blame? The FAI gets a yellow card. Sport Ireland suspends state funding. Is meat-free Monday an idea whose time has come? And the UK likely to get more time to make up its mind? All that and more on tonight's Late Debate, but first the news with Eileen Whelan. Thanks, Eileen. Good evening and welcome to The Late Debate. I'm Katie Hannan and joining us tonight we have Brendan Smith, Fianna Fáil TD for Cavan Monaghan and Chair of the Oireachtas Committee on Foreign Affairs, Trade and Defence. We have Pat Deering, Fine Gael TD for Carlow Kilkenny and Chair of the Oireachtas Committee on Agriculture, Food and the Marine. Donnacha O'Leary, Sinn Féin, Cork South Central TD and Spokesperson on Justice and Equality. Gerard Howland, Public Affairs Consultant and Irish Examiner Columnist and Niamh Lyons, Political Editor with the Times Ireland Edition. Now, we want to hear from you, so do get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email us on latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebaterte. Well, it has finally arrived. And wouldn't you know it, in the middle of one of the busiest news weeks we've had for some time. The PricewaterhouseCooper report on the Children's Hospital overrun was before Cabinet this morning and went online this afternoon. And as the Taoiseach rather memorably told us, it makes for grim reading. Here's Simon Harris speaking on the 6-1 News earlier.
We now have a very detailed document, 130 pages. They've interviewed over 50 people. They've read thousands of documents. What I'm now going to do tomorrow is meet with Children's Health Ireland, the people who'll be running the new Children's Hospital. And I'm going to meet in the coming days with Fred Barry, the man I've appointed to be the new chair of the Children's Hospital Development Board. And in 4 weeks' time, myself and Pascal Donoghue will come back to government.
Simon Harris there speaking earlier. Pat Deering, the Minister, all business there, all sorts of things that need to be done and people to be met and reports to be looked at. Grim reading doesn't come close to what's in this report today, surely.
Yeah, one could argue that, Katie, absolutely. But first of all, I think it was important that the report was published and it was important that PwC were given time and space to do the report, as has been outlined earlier on. It does indicate a number of deficiencies, obviously, and it indicates a number of recommendations that report that have to take place in order for these things not to happen again. But one key point, I suppose, is that to re-tender was not going to be the right particular action to take. It was going to make sure that there was going to be severe difficulties. It was going to ensure there was going to be substantial extra costs and possibly the hospital not being built at all. And that was the key point, I think. The fact that...
Pat Deering, I don't think that was the astonishing, mind-boggling list of deficiencies, as you refer to them, of oversights, of overruns that is set out in black and white in this report. That is the key point, surely.
Oh yeah, that's one of the key points. There's obviously indicated a number of points there, Katie. But it also did say, as I said a few minutes ago, Katie, the fact that if it was to be re-tendered, it was going to result in substantial extra costs.
But what the report said, Pat Deering, was that it was because the overrun wasn't spotted until it was too late. So it was too late to call back the horses at that stage.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I'm not
trying
to call.
It was actually the decision, saying you were right not to re-tender at that stage, was because it had been allowed to develop into the situation it developed without anybody noticing, apparently, and without the Minister for Public Expenditure being told, or without the Taoiseach apparently being told.
Yeah, no, I'm not denying that at all, Katie, and as the Taoiseach did indicate, it does make for grim reading, absolutely. And obviously it did indicate that there was substantial issues not addressed along the process, there was overruns, that there was underestimations, that there was planning issues. First of all, it has to be pointed out, this is a massive project, the biggest project in the history of the state.
Exactly, so you would think that every T would be crossed, there would be huge oversight, total focus on getting it right.
Absolutely.
So, and there wasn't.
No, there wasn't. That's why, first of all, PwC were asked to do this particular review at substantial cost to the state. That's a key point as well. Substantial cost, and it's important that they have now, the report is now out. The recommendations are there to be implemented. And it is important now that the Minister will come back, as he has said, that within 4 weeks with his implementation plan, so to ensure that we do not have any substantial overruns over and beyond where they are at the moment, and that these things don't happen again.
Would you not blush going to people's doors now in the run up to the next election and say, trust us with the finances of the country? We are the party of fiscal rectitude. Trust us Wouldn't you have to blush if you had to say that to anyone on a doorstep?
There's two points to that, Katie. First of all, on that particular point, I think we have a very good record as regards the economics of this country. We've bought the country back from where it was 7 or 8 years ago. We have a balanced budget for the first time in 8 or 9 years. That's a key point as well. I think it's very easy to put it down to one particular issue. With regard to the hospital itself, there has been ongoing, I suppose, for 20 odd years, 30 odd years, maybe 40 years, there's been a discussion about building the children's hospital. It hasn't happened. I take the point that there's a substantial cost involved over and above what the regional plan was, but the hospital needs to be built for the future of our children.
Oh, Brendan Smith.
Yeah, well, obviously we all want to see the National Children's Hospital developed, and it was a planning decision by Bord Pleanála in 2006 that stopped it going ahead at the matter. And that's regrettable now, because hopefully it would have been in place now.
In Bertie's constituency.
It doesn't matter where, if you're the right hospital, it'd be in somebody's constituency.
Well, I think actually where the children's hospital is situated matters quite a lot.
It does, and I tell you, if you were coming from my part of the world, finding James's Hospital wouldn't be the easy place to find. We'd find the matter a lot easier.
Well, you'd have trouble now making your way into the matter as you would to James.
That's beside the point. The matter, we can all argue the merits of alternative location. But if it had to be built, say if the planning had to go ahead in 2006, we would have by now a modern, much-needed children's hospital. But the thing that comes across from the report today is the phrases that leap out at you in regard to significant failures, lack of sufficiently comprehensive or robust planning, all levels, lack of governance structure, red flags were missed. When the government signed off on the project at the end of 2017, the funding approved was 983 million. Today we're at 1.7 billion. And a clear message as well that you could be faced into another additional 300 million. It's absolutely appalling, the escalation in costs in this particular project. Absolutely no excuse. And at government level, both in the HSE, the Department of Health, the Department of Public Expenditure, further questions have to be asked right up to in political level.
Grim reading, Kate, is the text we've had in. Grim reading, Katie, in the Children's Hospital report. But who is going to take ownership and responsibility for this mess, says Mike in Limerick. Donica, is there going to be any responsibility taken, do you think?
Well, look, I mean, we've, from a very early stage, expressed our view in relation to this and in relation to other issues, the crisis in A&E, that we have no confidence in Minister Simon Harris. We put down a motion in relation to that. Unfortunately, it was not supported by other parties. So, like, I mean, we have a very clear view politically about the failures that exist. I think sometimes with these debates, like, I mean, those of us who are dealing with politics on a daily basis, and sometimes we get used to large sums of money, but I think the general public that's listening in is just appalled and just amazed at the kind of sums that we are now talking about. And a very clear implication in the report today that it's going to be very difficult. Indeed, it seems, reading between the lines, that it's almost unlikely that it will be within the 1.7 billion, that it could go much higher than that. So, like, I mean, this is a project now that it is approaching, and it's not the only project, I suppose, that is clearly exceeding the initial cost. We have an issue in Cork with the event centre, follows on a smaller scale, but it's still a significant scale, a very similar pattern. And we clearly have a problem with how we manage major public projects in this country to ensure that tenders are accurate. The Taoiseach, I think, was out trying to get out ahead of opposition politicians to say that people will try and exploit this and people will try and say that projects are being delayed or whatever. But, like, I mean, to attempt to say that you can have overruns of that size and that other projects won't suffer, like, I mean, I don't think the public will buy that for a second. It obviously has to have a real impact on health projects, on other projects right across the country, and it will.
Niamh, this is going to be an open sore, really, for the government in terms of, as Donica said there, any project that's coming down the line is going to be delayed now. There's going to be finger pointed at this.
It already is. I mean, if you look in local newspapers across the country, if potholes aren't filled, people are blaming it on the National Children's Hospital. Like, the unfortunate thing for the government now is the fact that this hospital isn't due for delivery until 2023. We very unusually have a report into failings of a project. before the midpoint has been reached of when it'll even be delivered. Now, we will get the satellite centres before that. So that can be used as a stick to beat them with all the way down the line as well. But I think something that was interesting that a lot of the opposition politicians pick up on today, there was a lot of talk of this kind of PR spin being the thing that took precedence. And I suppose when you see the picture of, you know, politicians in hard hats turning sods with their shovels in a particular location, that's been done to kind of give a clear message to the public, like, we're working, this is underway. The problem with that is that in any contract, any engineer, anyone who tenders for any contract will know, you live or die by the wording in that. And this project was more or less tendered without even proper design proposals in place. I mean, when we saw a story that Justine McCarthy wrote about a year ago, about the fire safety provisions. There wasn't enough of a burn time in the hospital if you needed to evacuate sick kids, basically. And that really plays into that notion that from the earliest possible point, while you might have had what Simon Harris tonight described as the who's who of development expertise, you didn't have the clinicians very early on saying, guys, this is a totally different project than what you're used to doing. I mean, in this country, governments have delivered multi-billion euro projects before. This is the first time they've done this type of a ground-up hospital on this scale for this cost. I mean, my feeling on it is going to be, I would be surprised if we got away with any less than 3 billion. I think it'll easily rocket.
Gerard.
Well, now they know that hospitals are more complicated than apartment blocks and office blocks.
The poor tunnel.
But too late. And I think to make a virtue tonight, as the government has, that the hole was so deep and the thing so far gone.
That they were right to keep going.
There was no climbing back out of it, and keep a straight face, take some cheek. The bigger issue, however, it is spilt milk now, is what's going to happen. And of course, nothing can happen. Because politicians at ministerial level are not expected, cannot be expected, to have the expertise to personally oversee these projects. That's not what they do. Their job is to put in place the systems and the personnel to do. The systems in place here weren't fit for purpose, and it seems neither were the personnel. And the nexus of this is in the senior reaches of the Department of Health, and in the Department of Public Expenditure. There has very long been a dysfunctional relationship between those two institutions, year in, year out. There's a cumulative overrun in current spending on health that is much more than the billion that's in the black hole in the foundations of this hospital on the St. James's campus. And that's now routine, regular, inbuilt into our health funding model, year in, year out, regardless. But the minister and his colleagues in government are not going to challenge those senior officials because they are more dependent upon them than, you know, they simply can't challenge them. So nothing's going to change. The people who had ultimate administrative responsibility will stay in place, and those who had political responsibility are going to walk on.
But I still come back to this, the mind-boggling part of this whole debacle that I just find it so hard to get my head around is that this... That nobody shouted stop. That if we were into also, tens of millions. Then it was hundreds of millions.
There's an issue,
and there was such an incredible breakdown that it didn't apparently land on any responsible politician.
Minister Harris, who clearly is a very fluent, able man with a very high IQ, I think he strikes me as being so. His capacity for avoiding information is astonishing. Whether it was the Children's Hospital, whether it was cervical check, whether it's a recent hiring freeze, whether it's those routine but massive overruns.
Sheree, that is a well-worn, skill that any long-serving minister would want to pick
up. But he's not long-serving. He has acquired it to a degree almost from the start.
It took others years to acquire. This government in particular are very good at pointing to a report and saying, well, isn't this just terrible? I mean, Simon Harris tonight in the 6-1 News was talking about how frustrated he is about these cost overruns, that this was not brought to the government's attention. The idea that, you know, you could have had someone, a senior official on the board of the project team, you know, making sure that someone from Department of Expenditure and Reform is running the ruler over every decision that was made.
Well, from my experience, civil servants are quite good at reporting back up the line to their senior people, and that goes on to the political person in charge of the department. This issue arose around the time of the budget, And every senior official...
It also arose government, around the time that there was a lot of talk that we may have a snap general election.
Yeah, but that, they weren't going to disclose it at that time if they thought there was going to be a general election.
But it just wasn't raised by Fianna Fáil either, was it, Brendan?
Sorry?
It wasn't really raised in discussions with...
But Fianna Fáil had not been told in the pre-budget discussions that there was any issue in regard to an overrun. That has been stated quite clearly.
There were no questions asked either, Brendan, so far
but
as...
But we were told that the capital budget was X amount provided for it and was running on profile or whatever. But the situation is that officials between the Department of Health and the Department of Public Expenditure, at budget time, they're consumed and prepared in estimates, be it capital or current. And to think that that wasn't flagged, that there was a serious overrun in the most major project in the country, I get it hard to believe that.
Do you find that hard to believe, Pat Deering?
Yeah, it is. There's no doubt about it. It is strange. You know, to say the least. You know, that's why I suppose it is important that, you know, that PwC were given the time to have their investigation to come up with the recommendations.
But I mean, I read the executive summary. I didn't go get into the detail of the entire report today. But is there anything in there to explain this strange issue, as you put it?
Well, I didn't get an opportunity to read the report, to be quite honest. I don't know today. I was in committee all day, you know, but, you know, this is something that from day one frustrated me, to be quite honest. The fact that, you know, it would have been gone unnoticed, the fact that it would have been gone to an extent, you know, and there's no doubt it would have been exercising a lot of people's minds right around the country over the last period of time. But, you know, PwC now have given the report. They've issued a number of recommendations which need to be implemented straight away or within the period of time that has been indicated. I mean, that's you know, and obviously a lot of lessons have to be learned from this. Structures have to be put in place to make sure that this will not happen again.
I mean, some of the recommendations in the report are so matter of fact and common sense that it's astonishing that we have to pay somebody €450,000 to write them down in a report, that they should be a more questioning scrutiny within the department in relation to these issues.
Yeah, but if we were to get the department...
Really, do we need a consultant firm to get them to pay them €450,000 to get us...
Yeah, but if we were to get somebody from the department to do it, the criticism would be, sure, it's not independent. It's, you know, it's the department.
The point is that these very expensive consultants felt they need to actually put this in writing as a recommendation, that it was so not being followed beforehand.
Yeah, you know, but I think it's an independent report. Everybody wants an independent report. It took it away from the political system to come up with something that was independent, you know, and that's what's happened now. You know, we mightn't like the recommendation, mightn't like what the report...
I'm not taking any issue with the recommendation.
You know,
the report's fine. What I'm saying is that, is it not embarrassing, a massive embarrassment for the government, that this is the level that these consultants feel must be brought to...
Yeah, there's no doubt there's nothing really new in the whole report from what I can see so far. Nothing really new. You know, apart from the fact that everybody knew that there was issues with regards to the governance. Like, a number of people have already resigned in this matter, stood aside. You know, there's nothing new about that. The recommendations have been put in place now to try and improve, try to make sure this doesn't happen again, to put a structure in place that when we're dealing with infrastructure projects of this nature and this size and this scale, that will be dealt with in a more efficient manner.
But the political response seems to be, look, nobody told us, what could we do? That seems to be is a shrug of the shoulders. It's grim reading, but sure, what could we do? They never told us this was going on. Onward we go, spending the €2 billion.
But this comes back to the point that those who apparently didn't tell, as they certainly should have, given the scale of the issue, they're still in situ.
Well, what about the not asking? I mean, it's one thing that people didn't tell, but why were these questions not being asked and being regularly asked and ongoing reports demanded?
I think that's an important point because, like, I mean, Brendan has said and Pat has said, like, you know, we weren't told. Like, I mean, this isn't also in the context of the government is saying this is one of the most significant capital projects, the most expensive project, I suppose, the government is handling at this moment in time, the most expensive hospital. Clearly, it should have been a political priority. It's something that's been discussed for 20, 25 years. Should have been a priority for officials in the Department of Health. But Simon Harris, and I believe Fianna Fáil, in negotiations around the...
But hold on one second. I
supply
told you already.
Should have, yeah.
This is the type of misrepresentation continually.
I'm
by
misrepresenting anything.
You're misrepresenting Fianna Fáil, and I not accept that. We were not told that there was any overrun in the capital.
Yeah, that doesn't contradict the word I said, no, Brendan. I specifically said, your line is that you weren't told.
Your line,
point is that there should have been, you could have been asking questions about the most significant health project the most significant capital project by the same way government and the minister could have been asking questions, the officials in the Department of Health should have been asking questions. If you're going to keep this government in place, then you need to be asking questions.
Yeah, well, I tell you, we're not into street politics like some organisation when we don't have an executive in Northern Ireland and we don't have people taking their seats in other parliaments. But I just want, I don't want the total misrepresentation that Sinn Féin are continually good at. Michael McGrath explained exactly that we had no indication whatsoever that there was any overwhelming...
Keep the old
misrepresentation going. Can I just say, Katie, as well, there's constant reporting to government by departments on their expenditure profiles. Mm. And I don't know how that didn't come to the political heads of departments. Okay. Or be reported to full government.
Okay, we're getting texts in saying, quite rightly, that we're not mentioning the 631 people on trolleys today. Mm. Yeah, Niamh, it's the astonishing thing about this. I mean, we covered these trolley stories so much, but this time of year, yeah, with mild weather, no flu, none of the reasons we're constantly hearing, contribute to these massive spikes. I mean, it really does give you a sense of a system creaking.
I mean, it's a trio of crises that are currently enveloping Simon Harris, because the cervical cancer issue came up again in the Dáil today as well. But I mean, this is one of those issues where it could be a bit of a hangover from the nurses' strike, perhaps, although people don't tend to wait to get sick. It could also be something to do with the weather, the idea that it was kind of warmish March and then it got freezing again at the beginning of this month. But it's a typical, you know, demand-led system where there's never a way in health of planning. And that's why you have such hairy overruns at the end of each year, because these types of things crop up out of nowhere and there's really no way of knowing, you know, how to plan for them. And then today, leaders' questions and order of business was dominated by a lot of issues in Cork University Hospital, crazy delays of ambulances coming in and out, yeah, not being able to respond across the south of Ireland.
Donegal, that's your constituency down there.
Yeah, and I was contacted by a lot of people who experienced the chaos really in the A&E in the Cork University Hospital last week. And indeed, there's, I think, 50 odd people on trolleys today, again in the CUH. Trolleys queuing up outside the hospital, ambulances queuing up outside the hospital, long times to get people even into the hospital. Like, I mean, there are wards vacant in the CUH. It's a lack of staff, so far as I understand, that's preventing that being opened up. Yeah. And, like, I mean, one story that I heard was that, like, I mean, there was triage nurses looking for people in the waiting room in the A&E and they could hardly find them. Like, it was that full, waiting for people.
But as it happens, I put down a night on a trolley in CUH not too long ago, and it was trolleys being stacked up one behind another in the corridors, nurses and doctors literally running, not walking between patients, running. There was people flying past us all night, and I was talking to the doctors and the nurses on duty there and saying, God, how do you, you know, this is incredible circumstances to be working on. They said, oh God, it's way worse than this normally. Mm. And I mean, I think people forget, because I think what was really shocking for me, that some of the very frail elderly people who were in that position, it's quite disturbing to see that this was considered not a bad night in CUH.
The amount of time that we've heard about this nut being cracked, I mean, all the way back to Harney and before. But then, you know, when James Reilly became health minister in 2011, there was a new emphasis. Obviously, this was a big element of Enda Kenny's 2011 general election campaign, no more people on trolleys. I mean, that has now kind of shifted to no more people in hotel rooms and homeless kids. But, like, we had experts from all over the world. There was, like, Dutch models being spoken about. There was experts coming in from Manchester telling us how to manage this and how quickly someone should be admitted or sent back and, you know, the awful word bed blockers and whatever. We've still never managed to crack that nut. And it's not quite understandable why we haven't.
I've got a text in here. I'm screaming at the radio. I was a card-carrying member of the Fianna Fáil party. No longer. How much longer will they prop up this inept administration? Homelessness, the trolley crisis, cervical smear scandal, the overruns at the Children's Hospital. I hold Fianna Fáil responsible for not holding Fine Gael to account, says Breed. Brendan.
Yeah, well, we're very unhappy with the government's lack of progress in regard to the issues that have been raised there by the, your text, or be it housing, homelessness. But just to go back to the crisis, ongoing crisis in A&E, like there are no epidemics, thankfully, or no major flu crisis at the minute. And generally, we associate the huge numbers in A&E departments when there's a flu or another epidemic. Mm. Now, the situation is, and all of us as public representatives in the Dáil constantly raise the issue of inadequate provision for home care packages. We go to any hospital tonight, there are people medically discharged and they're still in an acute hospital bed because the package hasn't been put in place to allow them to go back to their own home.
Last week where we saw the announcement that we're now going to extend free GP care to under 12s.
Which is mad.
The idea that
a really scarce resource at primary care level is going to be devoted to extend free care to 12-year-olds is insane. It is wanton waste of a very scarce resort when, however desirable it might be, there are many, many things more urgent. And, you know, Brendan's mentioned the lack of home care to get people out of hospital. But, of course, there's so much being done in hospital that's not done in hospitals in better-run systems. Now, I know that's in some agreement that hasn't been finalised that might be rolled out, but we are 7 or 8 years later, as Niamh pointed out, into a government that came in 2011 on the basis of a Dutch model. If you're in the Netherlands, you can go to your pharmacist if you have diabetes, who will monitor your blood levels. We're light years away from that. And given the hard years the government did have to deal with in 12, 13 and 14 and 15, you know, they hadn't got the resources to have a magic cure. But what they did have was a plan in 2011 that was subsequently completely abandoned. And now we're on the second plan, something called Sláintecare. But that plan, Sláintecare, is predicated on it being situated in the Department of the Taoiseach so that the reforms can be driven. Actually, contrary to that, it's situated in the Department of Health, where it has to challenge the department. It is effectively enclosed, not to say imprisoned within. And you have a HSE board that's being reappointed after it was disbanded. And that HSE board is looking at something called Sláintecare in the Department of Health, setting out policy parameters about which it is not being consulted at all, but which will have all the responsibility for funding, minding and implementing.
Pat Deering, going back to that GP promise, that latest policy initiative, that's just pure electioneering, isn't it?
No,
as George Howland said there, a really scarce resort, a resource that we were told were overwhelmed when the under six case came in the door, because children with very little wrong with them were overwhelming the system while people who really needed to get in there were struggling.
Yeah, it's a very complicated system, as we all know. If it was as easy to sort out, it would have been sorted out a long, long time ago.
It's not complicated about offering free GP care to under 12s in the run up to an election. No. That's not a complicated
notion. If we could go back a little bit, first of all, I think we all know we have an ageing population. I think we have to have an honest discussion about how we're going to be able to plan for that ageing population over the next period of time. If you go into A&E, as you said, you were done. I had reason to be in A&E not that long ago myself, and the vast majority, unfortunately, of patients who were on trolleys were elderly people who, one could argue, should have been there in the first place. There were probably maybe people who may have been living at home on their own and acquired some bit of an issue, be it a fall or whatever the case may be. And, you know, we'll have to be able to plan, be it a nursing home, be it more home care packages, as Brendan has indicated. You know, and that has to be developed further. The community has to play a huge part, you know, and
We all know this. We all agree on this point. This is not a point of difference in policy. Yeah. What I'm saying is, why in the middle of the crisis that we see within the health system at this point in time would you throw out the offer for all children under 12 to get free GP care?
Because there are people in this country at the moment, Katie, who have children of that age who are struggling to pay their way, who need a bit of a break, and this is a break for them potentially going forward over a period of time. It is expensive, obviously, to go to the doctor. If you have a child tomorrow morning who may be sick, it'll cost you 50 or 60 euro, whatever the case may be, and that is it's a help. If you have a child who has to go to the doctor on a regular basis for every particular reason, every 50 or 60 euro is another costly expense, and this is a break for them.
But there is also plenty of people out there who can well afford to take their children to GPs, and they are going to get it for free as well. So why put out a universal benefit at a time when the resource is so scarce.
But it is a gradual process. It's not going to happen overnight for the under-12s. It is a gradual process, the very same as the other Mamas up to now.
But the people who can afford it are going to get it just as quickly as the people who can't.
But it is also part of, and Gerard mentioned about Sláinte Care, and this is part of the Sláinte Care proposal whereby, you know, it will do away with the two-tier system. As everybody talks about a two-tier system, you know, this is it's a part of that process that's going to take a bit of time, obviously, and this is one step along the way.
But could I just say, Katie, as well, another crisis looming in the whole healthcare is the GP and the lack of resourcing of GP and the lack of numbers of GP. There are many practices in rural Ireland, small-scale practices, where I know GPs who would be retiring in a few years' time. They tell me there's not a chance that there will be a replacement to keep those practices open. So that will mean more work going to hospitals as well when there's not easy access to GPs who cannot cope with the demand on their services at the present time.
We're getting a huge response in on this health issue. Very general questions. Katie, what terrifies me is that these fools are responsible for maternity services. Have you been listening to Joe Duffy? Maternity services are dire in this country. There has been some very disturbing stories being told on the Joe Duffy show this week in relation to people's personal experiences in maternity services in this country. No more excuses, says Mary on another text. The health situation is a total disgrace. What are these politicians doing? They're devoid of any humanity. They won't get my vote. As soon as Brexit is sorted this week, Fianna Fáil should pull out of supply and confidence. Country is a joke. Could your guest withdraw the bed blocker terminology as it suggests blame on the service user? It's due to an inept system.
Just to say, I didn't call on you. I said that was the word that was being used. And I mean, I said it because I thought it was so abhorrent at the time, this idea that the blame was being shifted onto the person for being there rather than the fact that the system wasn't able to cope.
One final text. My elderly and ailing father chose not to go back to the Mater Hospital A&E when he was very ill because of the horrific and degrading time he had on trolleys in previous visits. He died at home a few weeks later. That was 2006. Shame on our health service.
You hear that a lot, people.
But Katie, I think it is important to point out as well, a lot of very good work takes place in hospitals as well. You know, for every bad story you may hear, there are 10 good stories. You know, you'll never hear the good stories.
No, well, I think what needs to be said actually is that there are some incredible clinicians, absolutely, nurses, staff, and I can attest to that, working in really appalling conditions in many cases.
The same clinicians contribute to the malfunction of the system, because in their representative bodies, you know, they're very strong and very clear about their vested interests. So they work like Trojans as individuals, but as a groups, I can tell you, I don't like some of the stuff they do, frankly.
And some of it, like when you've been listening to what has been coming up on Joe Duffy, what you realise is that, you know, we're constantly told, you know, we have the best maternity services in Europe and blah, blah, blah. It's actually women muddling through a system themselves and kind of finding the inner strength to get through something. I mean, I know when I was in hospital myself, I didn't even ring my little buzzer button when I needed to, because I could see there was one nurse on duty that night. There was six of us in the room. She was flat out with all the other patients. And I was like, look, I can't put pressure on her at this point. I think a lot of people in the system feel that way. Even elderly people who are stuck in a trolley, they almost, you know, take for granted that they don't deserve proper care when they get in there. And they're lucky that they have the hospital staff, good hospital staff, to lean back on.
Okay, we're going to move on, because much was made of Sport Ireland CEO John Tracy's discomfort last week when he was asked if he had confidence in the association when he was before the Oireachtas Committee. Let's just play that moment again when John Tracy was asked, does he have confidence in the FAI board?
My specific question was, do you have confidence in the FAI board? So yes or no answer.
But I'm not saying yes.
John Tracy there responding to Imelda Munster. Of course, John Delaney is before the Oireachtas Committee tomorrow. But before that, just before 5 o'clock today, Sport Ireland revealed that it has moved to suspend funding to that organisation. RTÉ's football pundit Richie Sadler gave this reaction shortly after that news broke.
I think the key issue is just how long the funding will be withdrawn for. Sport Ireland have said, and the FA have responded to it tonight, that they will consider reinstating the funding once the reports are concluded, once certain recommendations have been put in place and other processes and safeguards are put in place around grant conditions. So it's up to the FAI now to respond. It'll be interesting to see if it is any material difference in the level of support that the board of the FAI in the current regime of Irish football, whether it has any material difference on the level of support out there.
Gerard Howland, that was quite a surprising move, actually, ahead of the actual appearance of John Delaney and, yeah, and the other FAI reps.
It's the second time this has happened that I can recall. The last time I remember was 20 years ago, with then Minister for Sport, James McDaid, suspended support to Swim Ireland. It wasn't called Swim Ireland, it was the predecessor organisation at the time, over sexual abuse in the sport.
Yes, we should say there's an entirely
different,
completely
absolutely,
different.
And there's no, however, it is the second, and I suppose what happened then is that an organisation that was much more dependent on that money than the FAI is dependent on government money now was essentially brought to heel. It was disbanded and completely recreated. None of this is possible now because the amount of money is, relatively speaking, less important to the FAI. The sport is much bigger. And the unfortunate thing is that I think we can focus on personalities and of course they're mesmerising, but this is a systemic issue within the FAI, within both the culture and the organisation of the sport of soccer in this country, literally over a generation. And I'm not sure that that's been taken on board by people in the sport at grassroots level who have responsibilities to the sport and to the organisation, as well as legitimately saying, we're volunteers, we give of our best to do a good job. And I understand all of that. But they have sustained something that seems to me to be out of kilter with any kind of norm that can be supported any longer.
When you say that, you're talking about the governance structures and the longevity of the various...
Longevity, and to be brutally ageist, the longevity of very old people. This is like the Kremlin before the USSR collapsed. And with one or two exceptions, it's...
Well, I won't have any ageism in this studio.
Well, I think the fact that you have a large group of very senior citizens who have been there together for a very long time smells.
Certainly, well, women certainly having to, the women's team having to get out of their tracksuits in the loo in Dublin Airport and pass the tracksuits. So maybe Jerry's right, maybe there should be much more diversity and perhaps that's something that will be explored. The committee itself tomorrow will be interesting. I mean, it's going on for the whole day. They are going to be hamstrung in a way from their questioning of everyone, not just John Delaney. I mean, we had a ruling recently in the Supreme Court in relation to the Angela Cairns case. That means, you know, you really can't attempt to drag somebody's reputation to the mud. They're going to have to try and really stay on message here. There can't be any grandstanding.
But having said that, we already have one member, at least one member of that committee, Noel Rock, who has... express the view that John Delaney should step down.
I think what you'll see more is that perhaps there will be some questions that the people there simply won't be able to answer. Now, I had a story...
No, but in relation to that, is that not jumping the gun in terms of the promise to give the FAI and John Delaney fair procedures and a fair hearing?
In fairness, I actually think that question about his tenure is a totally different one for the committee, because that position that was created, you know, Sport Ireland themselves want oversight on that or how it came about. So, yeah, I mean, should politicians call for resignations ahead of these kind of meetings? I heard Noel Rock explaining himself in that regard in the radio yesterday, but I mean, from a broader perspective, I think today there was a meeting earlier today, and I think you're going to see a certain amount of synergy in the way the questioning takes place among the politicians. They'll pick up on what each other is doing, and you know, the aim here tomorrow, I don't think, is for the politician to get a clip of themselves in the 6-1 News banging the table. The aim here actually really is to get the answers.
Are you sure? Are we sure well. About that? Politicians not aiming to get a clip of themselves on the 6-1 news.
Yeah, first of all, I suppose I come from business, from a sporting point of view. In a previous life, I had a big involvement in the GA. I was formerly a chairman of the county board in Carlow. And governance is a big issue in all sports organisations. In that regard, you're confined to, you're a time limit in regard to the position you could stay in. You had to move on after a period of time, which I think was very good at the time. You know, and that's something that, I suppose, soccer and the FAI in general haven't carried on. That's a big issue. The big fear I have is that those who are most vulnerable, who are benefiting most out of the money, are going to lose out, or potentially going to lose out. I would sincerely hope that it wouldn't happen.
Seems like it has to happen, because we heard from Sport Ireland that they were very confident that the money that they had that they've already given to the FAI, that it goes to where it's supposed to be going, which is these grassroots programmes.
Yeah.
So it stands to reason, if that money stops...
Oh yeah, but 2.9 million, which is quite a bit of money, even though it may not be as big as Gerald said, compared to the other organisation you mentioned.
Well, they have a budget, a turnover of 50 million, yeah. So
but still, it's 2.9 million. It's quite a lot of money to go to the grassroots organisation. 50% of that money has already been paid in this particular year, my understanding, and 25% is due to be paid again in August. You know, in the event that the FAI get their act together and put a new governance structure in place, there's no reason why by August that money could not be paid in a normal fashion, and subsequently after that, the rest of the money could be paid to those who were, in my opinion, deserving of it. And that's I think, even though the person, it's all about the personality, it has been about the personality up to now, I think we must be conscious of the fact that, you know, these are the person, the young players down at under 14 or under 12, whatever the case may be level, that they potentially could lose out and they need to be looked after.
But that personality we keep talking about is John Delaney, obviously. I mean, he would say, and he has his supporters, that he has brought big gigs into this country, that he says he's killed from running around to all the sports club or the football clubs around the country at weekends, looking after the grassroots, making sure that they're getting what they need. You know, is there a danger of throwing out the bath with the bath
water?
Yeah,
well, one thing about it, where state funding is going to any organisation, we have to have proper corporate governance. There's no question about that. And audited accounts have to be accurate. The financial accounts have to be accurate. We had the FAI contradicting themselves in two or three statements in regard to this 100,000 bridging loan. The situation is, and it's great credit due to the volunteers throughout the country, there has been a phenomenal growth and development of facilities for small soccer clubs. I know to my own constituency and a neighbouring county.
Does John Delaney not get any credit for that?
Well, I have been at openings and I have been at different events, and he seems he knows the people on the ground from what I could see, and he seems to be very popular with them. And I wouldn't be that familiar with the workings of any particular clubs, but I have seen that at first hand. And there has been a great development of facilities. But you take it, there's many the person around the country tonight cleaning up dressing rooms, washing jerseys, all volunteers. And it's so disappointing for those volunteers who are doing this week in, week out, to see their favourite sport getting such adverse publicity brought upon it by themselves, by their hierarchy.
Yeah, Donica.
Well, I think are there clubs that have their facilities improved? Certainly there have. But, the FAI has a large budget, and a lot of this would have come from sports capital grants and county council grants and things like that. I don't think the FAI deserve all the credit for that. FAI isn't monolith. There's a lot of good people, even at, you know, higher up levels, you know, that are very committed soccer people and committed to delivering for community football, for schoolboy soccer and for the national team. But one of the big failures, from a footballing point of view, 6 or 7 League of Ireland clubs have gone out of business, including some of the oldest clubs in the country, while John Delaney has been in charge. The failure to try and some of those clubs, you bring in this licensing regime, how some of these clubs actually got these licences is beyond me, frankly, when you consider and you see some of the things that have developed after the fact, with the lack of governance, with the accounts and all the rest of it. And there's very few League of Ireland fans, I would say, that would have much sympathy for John Delaney and for indeed the board at this juncture.
I think that's a key point. I think it'd be very unfair to give John Delaney and the FAI credit for all the facilities they have. The vast majority of that has come from sports capital funds over the last number of years.
Prepaid.
And I actually would say, and this is government funding as well, by the way, and I would actually say that the FAI have failed miserably since Jack Charlton era of 30 years ago, when, you know, Irish soccer became huge and, you know, the following started to increase and became very popular. You know, very little money has actually been delivered down to the grassroots in that 30 years. years. You know, we're talking about 2.9 million of government funding now to try and make sure that the grassroots at the very low level is going to be maintained for the future. So I would say John Delaney and the board of the FAI, be it him or the board, have failed miserably in that regard. Donica mentioned the League of Ireland. Again, that has struggled over the last period of time. My understanding is that the prize money for the winners of the League of Ireland is only a fraction of John Delaney's salary. You know, which I think speaks volumes. Mm.
Indeed. Well, we will no doubt be talking about this again tomorrow because we'll be waiting with bated breath to see what John Delaney is going to tell us at that committee. But I'm going to have to take a break now. But stay with us because we'll be looking at Theresa May's dwindling options after these.
Email latedebate@rte.ie. The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back to Tuesday's Late Debate. In studio tonight, we have Fianna Fáil's Brendan Smith, Sinn Féin's Donal O'Leary, Fine Gael's Pat Deering, Public Affairs Consultant Gerard Howland, and Niamh Lyons of the Times Ireland edition. Now, Theresa May went on her whistle-stop tour of the leaders that matter in the European Council ahead of tomorrow's Council meeting. While back in London, the talks with Jeremy Corbyn appear to be floundering, and just 131 of her MPs backed her motion to approve her decision to seek an extension of Article 50. Gerard, where do you think this is going to land tomorrow?
The can will be kicked down the road because the Conservative Party is slowly splitting.
Rather quickly splitting now.
Well, perhaps, yes. The Conservative Party and the Labour Party are not coming together. There is no majority for anything. And the EU has a simple choice. Let them crash out or keep the thing going for another while and see what happens. And they're going to see what happens.
There is, I hear, talk of revoke being brought into the narrative.
Yeah, even the Taoiseach today said down the line in 10 or 20 years, if they want to come back, we'll open them with welcome them back with open arms. Like, that's kind of fantasy stuff, to be honest with you. You know, even in his phone call with Theresa May, and obviously the latest buzzword is flextension, but he spoke with her by phone last night and she was very firm on the notion that she still wants to be able to leave as soon as she gets that withdrawal agreement through. Now, some people might think that that is never going through and that whatever resolution this comes to, but I mean, she had to be reminded, and certainly members of her own cabinet had to be reminded this week, that even if Britain were to crash out in the morning, the questions from the very early part of this negotiation in relation to the Irish border, the financial settlement and citizens' rights, that is all there facing Britain the morning after a crash out. Things can't move on with the trade deal unless that's all dealt with. You know, and I mean, there's a very interesting point of difference now emerging, obviously, between Emmanuel Macron and Angela Merkel. Merkel's kind of like looking towards her legacy here and probably wants to get things tidied up neatly before she leaves her job as German Chancellor. Macron, I mean, I was in Paris last week with the Taoiseach when he met Emmanuel Macron and Lise, and one of the things I couldn't get over was the amount of French exit posters all over Paris. So he's looking to that idea that a hard Brexit at the very least would send shockwaves through the French system. And also the idea that, I suppose, you could have kind of, in a sense, a second referendum through the European and local elections, that you'd have people standing on either a very strong Leave platform or a very strong Remain platform, and that a lot of the Brexiteers that got into the European Parliament, even if it's only for a very short time, could actually cause chaos.
Yeah, Brenda Smith, you're a candidate in those Euro elections. But it's not, it won't affect your constituency, but this issue about whether or not there is going to be the UK are going to field candidates in this European election, the forthcoming European election, could have a big effect on the outcome, couldn't it?
Absolutely. We could be down two seats, it would appear. So I'm sure it'll be a constitutional lawyer's field.
Yeah, because I'm thinking, surely that will make a difference. That will make a difference to what the quota is going to be.
Well, it depends if you calculate say in Dublin, if you calculate for Munster.
Well,
say,
they'll be elected, but they're going to be quite in what's called cold storage.
Yeah. But I could imagine questionable itself, really.
Like it has
PRS, and to be honest with you as well, in a European election, because the votes and the constituency are quite different from a general election, you could very easily see a legal challenge by someone who got the so-called last seat in either South or Dublin.
Mm-hmm. Sure, it'll be a field day for constitutional lawyers. You can imagine this ending up in the European court.
Because this is not just in Ireland, it's all over Europe. There's going to be this constituency.
There was 2027 seats were reallocated, 46 not reallocated for future applicant countries when they're eventually new members. But could I just say, I was in Brussels at meetings yesterday. I gather that there's Brexit fatigue. Some of the senior people in Europe want to move on to the other major issues confronting Europe. And I was surprised today when I heard that Mr. Tusk was writing, suggesting to the heads of government or heads of state about a year's extension. I gathered from some people yesterday, and you heard Guy Verhofstadt last night on Clare Borden Show, very adamant that it was time to get this dealt with. And he still outlined very, very clearly that all Irish interests should be protected. But if we prolong uncertainty, it has a negative effect economically. It will have a negative effect socially and politically in this country as well.
Pat Dearing, you've been quite critical of Fianna Fáil's approach to the pre-Brexit planning and the no-deal planning.
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, I think it is important that that we do avoid a hard Brexit and a hard border at all costs. I mean, that has to be the ultimate aim here. It is quite obvious that there's not going to be a deal within the next number of days. So obviously an extension is what is most likely going to be agreed. But I would have a bit of concern about having an indefinite extension. The uncertainty that would be created is difficult. You know, and you know, my criticism in the past would have been the base that until we know exactly where we are, and that's the problem at the moment. Until we know exactly where we are, we can't go look for something that is possibly going to be there. And there is going to be...
I'll just quote back to you what you said in a recent statement, Pat. Maybe it's reassuring in these turbulent times to see that some things never change. Fianna Fáil continues to offer populist criticisms with no solutions.
Well, I think...
I stand over that.
And Pat is absolutely incorrect.
Lisa Chambers issuing a statement after the last particular arrangement whereby she said it was going to be easier to get over the backstop. Within 24 hours, that was contradicted by those involved.
We have been extremely responsible on all issues in regard to Brexit, and you should get the clip and listen to Mr. Verhofstadt, the chief negotiator with the European Parliament, where he praised Micheál Martin and the Fianna Fáil Party for the very responsible approach.
But Micheál Martin, as you know, Brendan, even criticised Lisa Chambers and contradicted her in this particular situation. She's our spokesman in that regard.
Our party has acted in exemplary manner as usual, particularly in relation to Brexit.
There has been such coherence from the Dáil. They could teach Westminster a thing or two. The Brexit legislation flew through because of everyone kind of putting on the green jersey. But hearing the Taoiseach today, when he was speaking during Taoiseach's questions about this issue, and he asked for a bit of kind of leeway from both the government and from the Dáil, that, you know, if you back Britain into a corner ahead of this Friday, they could essentially be pushed into a crash out. And we are getting closer and closer to that kind of sleepwalking into the crisis. But as Brendan says, that malaise is now kicking in. The idea that they could extend and pretend, that could actually come back to bite Ireland. You know, it's been a long time when there's been extreme discipline from all sides. It's hard to believe all other EU leaders have been so concerned with the Irish border. But one would imagine patience will eventually run out on this one.
Donegan.
Well, I suppose Ireland is in the situation that in this instance, and obviously in the recent past in relation to bank bailouts and all the rest of it, it wasn't the case, but the majority of European interests and Irish interests are aligned by and large in this instance, and it's in their interest, and it's in the interest of sending out a message to what EU membership can deliver for these member states to stand with Ireland. And I suppose we will see how patience will stand. But I think what is missing, though, in relation to it, is, and I think everyone agrees, it's becoming increasingly likely that there will be a hard crash of Brexit. I hope certainly that doesn't happen. I'm sure everyone is still working to ensure that isn't the case. But what needs to happen here is, in terms of preparation for a no-deal Brexit, is to put in place financial investment. And Sinn Féin has our Brexit Stabilisation Fund. The government hasn't anything of that kind proposed, and nor has Fianna Fáil. And I think, you know, there are going to be, particularly food and drink and export and freight and areas like that are going to be very adversely affected. We need financial supports for them to ensure that those businesses don't crash out themselves.
Okay, we only have a couple of minutes left, but I do want to come to this issue of the meat-free Monday. And this, of course, is the Antashka pamphlet, The Winter Round Schools, the resource pack, which was which encourages students to eat less meat and dairy and promotes veganism. Pat Deering, as chair of the Oireachtas Committee on Agriculture and Food, would you be in favour of a meat-free Monday campaign?
No. No, I believe it's important of a balanced diet. I think, you know, this whole debate has kind of, to be honest, I think it's got out of hand. You know, I think it's important of a balanced diet. You know, I think Antascar are not the appropriate people to give advice on what they should and shouldn't eat. You know, this agriculture.
Well, no, the IFA called on the various relevant ministers to intervene and yank these out of the schools. I think it's what they want. Do you think? That there should be intervention. I don't see it happening.
No, as I think, you know, it is not Antascar's responsibility or their role to advise on what people,
but they are in
kids
these,
should eat or not.
These resource packs are being distributed to schools. So should somebody intervene to stop that if you don't agree with it?
Yeah, well, they're online, Kate. They haven't been rolled out, Katie. It's my understanding. They're online at the moment. And, you know, that's my understanding. You know, I think constantly agriculture is being blamed for all the ills of climate change. And I think that's very unfair. I think agriculture has a part to play in trying to solve the issues in that regard. You know, and I think it hasn't been identified or hasn't been acknowledged the part that has been played already by agriculture in some of the issues that have been identified.
Brendan, don't tell him you're in favour of a balanced diet as well.
Oh, absolutely. I have to say, Minister Richard Bruton seems to have backed that Antascar campaign. If the Department of Health gives advice in regard to dietary and health requirements for people of all age groups, and they're the people should be recommending in regard to diets, not a voluntary organisation.
Okay, I'm going to have to sneak in a break here, but stay with us because I'll bring you the headlines after this.
Tweet at Late Debate RTE. The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And just time for a couple of the headlines. The Irish Examiner tomorrow is going with no sanction over Children's Hospital overspend, and also it's leading with FAI put under pressure as funds withheld. The Times goes with don't humiliate May, Tusk warns Macron, and Madonna to defy boycott of Tel Aviv Eurovision. And The Guardian has schools use fundraising sites to buy vital items. May hopes dashed as EU targets longer Brexit delay. And The Telegraph goes with that Brexit story as well, as does the Financial Times. I want to thank you all for listening. I want to thank my panel. Tonight's programme was produced by Brian Lally. Research was by Aoife Philbin Bowman. The broadcast coordinator was David Phelan, and Dave Gibson was on sound. And now it's over to Colin Murray on Late Date.